You know, I was looking at my phone this morning, just scrolling through a news feed, and I had this really sudden, very weird realization. I felt like I was in a room where the walls were moving.
Oh, that's a very specific feeling.
Yeah, like I felt free. I could scroll anywhere, click on anything, but I had this nagging suspicion that the room itself was, steering me toward a specific door I hadn't chosen. A
Yeah.
very subtle kind of claustrophobia.
That is a very specific and I would say legally accurate paranoia. You're describing the architecture of the modern digital experience, and believe me, you are not the only one feeling it.
And that's exactly what we need to unpack today. We have a stack of sources here that range from behavioral economics papers to, well, to some pretty heavy French philosophy from the 1980s. The mission today is to explore a paradox that sits right at the center of our lives. We operate under this illusion that artificial intelligence is an engine of infinite choice.
Which, to be fair, empirically it is. We have to give the technology its due here. It creates access. It surfaces job opportunities you would never have found on your own, these like perfect matches for your skill set. It analyzes health data to give you choices about insurance or your medical care that were previously just invisible. It expands the menu of human options.
Right, the menu gets bigger. But, and this is the counter premise, this is the scary part. While the menu of options is expanding, our ability to freely choose from that menu is being engineered out of existence. We're going to trace how simple nudges have evolved into what philosophers call a control society.
It's the shift from presentation to steering. And it's not science fiction anymore. It's the operational logic of the internet. We need to look at how these systems have moved from helpful suggestions to something that really resembles biological hacking.
Okay, so let's ground this.
Yeah.
Before we get to the dystopia, we have to start with the mechanics. The sources talk a lot about the nudge. This predates generative AI, right? This is old school behavioral economics.
Yeah. Early 2000s, Thaler and Sunstein. And the definition is crucial here because, on the surface, it sounds so benign. A nudge is a method of altering people's behavior in a predictable way without forbidding any options or significantly changing their economic incentives.
So, no gun to your head, no fine for non-compliance. You aren't forcing the horse to drink. You're just making the water look incredibly delicious.
Exactly. It preserves the illusion of agency. The classic analog example our sources cite is the elevator versus the stairs. Architects know that if you put a bank of elevators front and center in a lobby, 99% of people are going to take them. It's just the path of least resistance.
Human nature. A lot of energy conservation. I see a button, I'm gonna push it.
Right. But if you paint text on the stairs, something factual, like burn 5 calories per step, you see a statistical shift. A significant percentage of people start taking the stairs. Now notice what didn't happen. Nobody banned the elevator. Nobody paid you to walk. They simply changed the choice architecture to make the stairs more psychologically attractive.
It almost sounds helpful. You're giving people information they might want.
In that context, it is. Or take the supermarket layout. Placing chocolate bars at the checkout aisle is a nudge. You've just finished the cognitive labor of shopping. Your decision fatigue is high. Your willpower is out. It's depleted. The environment is engineered to capitalize on that specific moment of weakness to sell you sugar.
Okay, but that's static, right? The chocolate bar is there for everyone. The stairs say 5 calories to the CEO and the intern alike. The shift we need to discuss is what happens when you introduce machine learning into that architecture.
And that's where behavioral economics goes on steroids. It moves from static to dynamic. And AI doesn't just paint the stairs. It analyzes your specific history, your biometric data, your mouse movements, your current emotional state to determine exactly what message will make you climb those stairs.
So it stops being a general suggestion and starts being a personalized key.
Precisely. It creates a feedback loop. The system observes your reaction to a nudge, learns from it, and refines the next one. It's no longer a passive environment. The environment is adapting to you in real time.
I want to pressure test this adaptation concept with a specific case study from the reading, because I think this is where the line between helping and manipulating gets really, really blurry. We have this fascinating and frankly, slightly disturbing report concerning the American Heart Association.
The AHA, right? And we should premise this by saying these are the unquestionable good guys. Their mission is fighting heart disease.
Sure, but they need funding. And the sources detail how they turned to data analysis to optimize charitable giving. They didn't just want to know who to ask for money. They wanted to know when to ask.
They were looking for high-value correlations, and they found a powerful one: grief. The data showed that people who have recently lost a family member to heart disease are just significantly more likely to donate.
Which makes sense. It's intuitive. You want to do something.
But the algorithm didn't stop at intuition. It optimized the timing. And this is where the machine learning comes in. It analyzed the temporal data and found a sweet spot.
Walk us through that window, because this is where the precision gets eerie.
Well, the data shows that if you ask a surviving family member for a donation, say 3 days after the death, the answer is almost always no. The grief is too raw, the intrusion feels offensive. But if you ask 6 months later, the answer is also likely no, or at least a much smaller amount, because that immediate fiery desire to fight back against the disease has faded.
So the AI pinpoints the exact window, maybe it's day 12, maybe day 14, where the grief is manageable enough to process a credit card transaction, but fresh enough to motivate high dollar action.
Correct. It identifies the moment of maximum conversion. And the proposal discussed in our sources goes even further than just timing. It's about the texture of the ask. We're looking at a future and the tech is here now, where an AI agent scans obituaries and social data to build a psychological profile of the survivor, just to tailor the pitch.
This is the part that really stopped me. So the system sees that the deceased has, say, a nephew who posts a lot about logic, science, and atheism, and a niece who is devoutly religious.
And it bifurcates the narrative. The avatar approaches the rationalist nephew with charts, research breakthroughs, and arguments about scientific efficacy. Donate to solve the problem. It then approaches the religious niece with themes of legacy, spiritual duty, and comfort. Donate to honor their memory.
It's the same destination, a donation, but two completely different psychological paths, custom paved for each user.
It creates a bespoke narrative designed to trigger that specific individual's compliance.
Okay, I have to push back on this, or at least play the advocate for the system here, because there's a utilitarian argument to be made, isn't there? If the end result is millions more dollars for heart disease research and nobody was forced to donate, they just heard a convincing argument. Where's the harm? Aren't we just optimizing for a better world?
That is the classic techno-optimist defense. And you could argue that your autonomy has technically increased. The AI has presented you with a relevant opportunity to take action against a disease that hurt you. You aren't being coerced. No money is taken without consent. You are simply being given a highly relevant choice.
Relevant. That's a heavy word there, because I feel like this crosses a threshold from opportunity into, well, into opportunism.
Yeah.
When you use my private grief, a moment of supreme vulnerability, as a lever to extract capital, even for a good cause, you are bypassing my rational consent. You're hacking my emotional state.
But where do you draw the line? I mean, that is the engineering problem. If we say don't use grief, do we also say don't use joy? Can a travel site not sell you a vacation when it knows you've just been promoted? The mechanism is identical. The AI is decoding human experience to maximize a conversion. In the AHA case, the conversion is a donation to science.
I think the distinction lies in the power dynamic. In the promotion example, I'm celebrating. I'm in a position of strength. In the grief example, I'm wounded. The source material raises a pivotal question. Do the rules of autonomy change because the goal is noble? If this were a scammer using the same tech to sell fake insurance, we'd call it predatory.
We would, without a moment's hesitation.
But because it's the heart association, we call it optimization. My worry is that the psychological impact on the grieving person is identical. They are being manipulated by a system that knows them better than they know themselves.
And that manipulation scales. A human fundraiser can maybe manage 20 leads intimately. An AI can scan every obituary in the world, cross-reference every relative, and deploy millions of personalized nudges simultaneously. It industrializes the exploitation of emotion.
Industrialized emotion, that's a haunting phrase.
It is. And it leads us directly into the darker side of this architecture, because at least the AHA has a life-saving justification. But when we strip away the nobility of the cause, we are left with what interface designers call dark patterns.
Right. I see this term popping up everywhere now. Define it for the listener who might not know the jargon.
A dark pattern is a user interface that has been carefully crafted to trick users into doing things they might not want to do. Like buying insurance with their purchase or signing up for recurring bills they can't figure out how to cancel. It's a nudge weaponized for profit.
The source mentions the sneaker example, which I think everyone has experienced.
Oh, it's classic. You're buying a pair of sneakers online. You're at the checkout. Suddenly, a pop-up appears offering shoe protection insurance. It's a product you almost certainly do not need. But look at the design. The yes, add to cart button is bright, pulsing. Maybe dark green or orange colors that signal go or safety.
And the no option.
It's usually grayed out, much smaller. Sometimes it's not even a button, but just a tiny text link that says, No, I'll take the risk.
Which is a psychological attack in itself. It frames the prudent decision as a dangerous one.
Exactly. It exploits cognitive drift. You're in buying mode. Your brain is just scanning for the green button to make the task end. You click it out of reflex. You've been nudged into a purchase not because you wanted it, but because the architecture tricked your eye.
But that's still a visual trick. It feels like a cheap parlor game. I want to go deeper into the biological reality of these systems.
Mm-hmm.
Because the sources argue that visual nudges are just the tip of the iceberg. The real mechanism isn't color. It's chemistry.
Right. Now we have to talk about the dopamine loop, and we have to talk about Facebook.
This is where we stop talking about psychology and start talking about neurochemistry.
Yes. Facebook and social media generally identified the biological lever of their platform very, very early on. Dopamine. It's a neurotransmitter associated with the brain's reward system. It's the same pathway activated by gambling, cocaine, or just eating a really good donut.
It's the seeking chemical, right? It makes you want more.
Exactly. It's not just pleasure, it's the anticipation of pleasure. And the like button is the syringe. Every time you get a notification, a like, or a comment, you get a microdose.
But here is what I didn't fully grasp until I read the technical breakdown. It's not random. The algorithm isn't just showing you likes when they happen. It's pacing them.
That's the variable ratio schedule. It comes straight from B.F. Skinner's experiments with pigeons. If you give a pigeon a pellet every time it pecks a button, it gets bored. But if you give it a pellet sometimes, maybe after 3 pecks, maybe after 20, the pigeon will peck until it drops dead. Uncertainty creates addiction.
So how does the code implement this?
The algorithm monitors your behavior in real time. It detects what's called exit behavior. It sees your scroll speed slowing down. It sees your mouse cursor drifting toward the close tab button or the top of the app. The system identifies that you are about to leave.
And that's when it fires.
Immediately. It surfaces a notification. It ensures a like appears on your recent post right at that second. It triggers a red badge. It pulls you back in.
It's weaponizing your own chemistry against your willpower.
It creates a chemical reward for staying. And this fundamentally changes the conversation about freedom. We can say, just close the laptop. But if your brain is being chemically incentivized to stay by a supercomputer that knows your breaking point, are you actually free to leave?
The source material uses a very provocative analogy here. It compares the platform to a drug dealer.
It fits the retention model. The user enters voluntarily. That's the freedom part. You sign up for Facebook to connect with friends, just as one might approach a dealer for a temporary high. But the business model is dependency. You gain the freedom of connection, but you lose the freedom of attention.
This is the trade-off we struggle with, because unlike a drug dealer, these platforms do provide immense utility. It connects families, it builds businesses, it organizes political movements. The freedom it grants is real, but the cost is this biological tether.
The engineering challenge, and this is something we debate in the field constantly, is whether you can decouple the utility from the addiction. Can we re-engineer these tools to optimize for autonomy instead of engagement?
But that asks a fundamental question about capitalism, doesn't it?
It does. It asks, how much profit are you willing to sacrifice for user sanity? If you remove the variable rewards, engagement drops, time on site drops, ad revenue drops. Is there a business model where maximizing human autonomy also maximizes profit? Currently, the answer seems to be no. The models are opposed.
This tension between the freedom to act and the invisible systems guiding those actions brings us to the final and honestly the most abstract concept from our sources. But I think it ties everything together. We need to talk about the control society.
And this takes us back to the French philosophers, Gilles Deleuze and Michel Foucault. Writing in the 80s and 90s, they were trying to imagine what comes after the modern era.
So Foucault is famous for describing the disciplinary society, right? That's the era of the factory, the prison, the school.
Right. The architecture of discipline is the mold. You are put into a mold. The factory tells you where to stand. The school tells you when to sit. The law says no. It's binary. You are either inside the walls or outside.
And Deleuze argued that we're leaving that behind. We're moving into a control society.
Exactly. In a control society, the walls come down. There are no prohibitions. You are technically free to go anywhere, do anything, say anything. The mold is replaced by modulation.
Modulation. Explain that.
Think of a sieve or a mesh that can change its shape. In a control society, governance doesn't happen through policemen telling you stop. It happens through data and passwords and access.
The source uses the highway analogy.
Yes. In the old world, you're in a room, you can't leave. In the new world, you're on a highway. You can drive anywhere you want, infinite freedom. But the highway has sensors. It tracks your speed. It tracks where you get off. And more importantly, the signage on the highway changes based on where the system wants you to go.
It's that locked room thought experiment we touched on in the intro. You feel free because you're moving. But you don't realize the road is being built in front of you as you drive.
That's the trap. In a control society, you aren't maneuvered by a force pushing you. You are maneuvered by an environment that predicts you. You flow through life thinking you are making choices, taking the elevator, buying the insurance, donating to the charity. But really, you are moving down a chute designed by a predictive algorithm.
And this is where the modern definition of freedom gets really complicated. We used to define freedom like Aristotle, giving rules to oneself, or even like Locke, doing what you want until it hurts others. But in a world of algorithmic nudging, doing what you want becomes suspect.
Right, because what you want has been manufactured. If the AI can predict what you will want before you want it, and then engineer the environment to make you want it, is the want yours? Or is it an implanted memory?
We are living in the science fiction experiment Foucault imagined. We have absolute informational freedom. I can look up anything. But the invisible hand of data is steering me constantly.
And unlike the 1980s theories, this isn't abstract anymore. Every interface is a soft cage. It guides you toward a commercial or political outcome while assuring you that you hold the keys.
So we have to ask ourselves, is there a way out? Or is the only way out to just understand the architecture?
Awareness is the only real defense. You have to learn to see the code in the matrix. When you feel that urge to buy the insurance or that little hit of dopamine, you have to stop and recognize it as a synthetic event. It's not a natural emotion, it's an engineered interaction.
But beyond personal vigilance, we need to ask what we want these systems to value. And that brings us to the ultimate question I want to leave you with today. We've covered the mechanics, the biology, and the philosophy, but we need to make a choice.
It goes back to the American Heart Association example. It's the perfect ethical crucible for this.
It really is.
Yeah.
Because it forces us to choose between two competing goods. On one hand, you have social welfare utilitarianism. If we allow AI to use these psychological nudges to exploit our grief, to hack our dopamine, we could solve massive problems. We could cure heart disease. We could maximize charitable giving. We could steer people toward health and away from self-destruction.
The ends justify the algorithmic means. If the result is a cure, does the manipulation matter?
On the other hand, you have privacy and autonomy. The belief that your grief is yours alone, that your mind is a sanctuary that should not be mapped and manipulated, even for a good cause.
The deontological argument, some boundaries are sacred, regardless of the utility.
So here is the question for you listening right now. If we accept that AI can manipulate our most vulnerable moments to maximize the social good, do we accept a world where our emotional autonomy is sacrificed for the collective welfare?
Is a cure for heart disease worth the cost of allowing an algorithm to operationalize your grief?
Or is the sanctity of your private emotion worth more than the cure? It's not an easy answer. But how you answer it defines what kind of society you want to live in.
Think about that the next time you see a suggested post.
Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. See you next time.